Hello and welcome back to a podcast about murder, and welcome to our sixth season. Before we get started, I had a little mess up with my headphones, so I'm not able to hear myself as I'm recording. So I'm hoping that there's not too many strange external sounds. And on the other side, Jem, you have a local bash going on.
Yeah, the ice rink, which is like right next to my flat, is having a party tonight, so there's not much I can do about that. I apologize if any of the banging tunes make their way onto the podcast.
Yeah, and I hope that's not a copyright issue.
No, yeah.
It's not intentional. but hopefully it won't be too disruptive.
Well, you said you couldn't hear it, so I'm hoping that it's not.
I couldn't hear it, yeah. So, if you don't know, I'm Freya, and I'm here with Jem, and I'm really excited to be back again doing more episodes. I think we left it a year again.
Classic.
Despite the fact that the very last thing that we said was, if it's another year, like, we might as well not bother.
Well, we're here, we're back.
But while we were away, if you follow us on social media, you may have seen the post that we hit 50,000 listens.
Very cool.
And that was massive for us because, as I've probably said before, I never ever thought we'd be anywhere near that at any point. I didn't think we'd receive the interest that we've received. So thank you. Thank you to everyone who joined us last season. We received some really nice comments and messages, and it's been really, really cool reading those. Obviously, we enjoy the conversations that we're having here with just each other, but it's so cool to know that there are like-minded people who are joining in those conversations, interested in the things that we talk about. So big thanks before we get started, and hopefully you all enjoy this season just as much as the last one. So are you ready to talk about murder today, Jim?
I'm ready. It's been a while. I've been preparing for this all year.
All your life. We're kicking this season off with a very brutal and prolific serial killing case, so getting right in there with that. It's an American case. It's the case of Carl Panzeram. I don't usually have so much of a desire to do American serial killers too often. I know we closed out last season with Son of Sam, which I was interested in talking about because of the potential multiple killer angle and the sort of theatre that surrounded David Berkowitz's post arrest. But when I started this podcast, I really wanted to try and cover more of cases that we don't see talked about so much already. Things people are more likely to maybe not have heard so far, especially if they are already interested in true crime and listening to podcasts. This is because obviously we really wanted to be adding something new to the table rather than like rehashing stuff that's been done so many times. And I feel like many of the American serial killers of the 70s to the 90s kind of period are a bit overdone in this format. People like Jeffrey Dahmer will probably never get an episode on this podcast, and that's just because I feel like it's been done so much.
Yeah, I feel like if you want to find, you know, not that we're completely unique in the cases that we cover, but like the big name ones, I feel like other people have done it and probably better than we would be capable of doing in like 40 minutes as we research, like, outside of the other things that we've got going on.
Yeah, well, don't sell ourselves too short, no. But yeah, I agree.
Like, there are so many documentaries and podcasts that cover those.
If there's people that have done it to the extent that it's going to be done, basically, and there are exceptions to that. If we do a classic, very well-known case, I always want to be in a zone where I feel like our conversation would be something new to add if we were going to. And or I want to be just interested in talking about it with you. And some exceptions would be, I guess, when we did like JonBenet and Son of Sam and stuff. Those are very big cases. But, you know, it's all just about how I feel.
Yeah. Long story short, it really just depends on the vibe. And you guys can take it or leave it.
But with that being said, today we're talking about Carl Panzeram, who is an American serial killer, although his story takes place in the 1920s, and I personally haven't seen too many podcasts cover him.
I've never heard of, like, I feel like I say this every time, but I don't think I've heard of this person outside of conversations you and I have had.
Okay, well, that's good. Karl Panzram was a prolific criminal who committed robbery, burglary, arson, rape, and murder of both children and adults. Much of the story of Karl's life and crimes is based on his version of events. Because of the time period, it lacks, like, bodies or other evidence to kind of back it up. And the time period certainly adds to that muddying of waters. But he confessed to 21 murders, and although most of these murders couldn't be confirmed, he was suspected of over 100 killings in the US and during his travels abroad as well. He also confessed to what he believed to be over 1,000 acts of sodomy, which were generally non-consensual.
Okay, so I was like, yeah.
The reason that I've said it like that is because it's not, like, it's, yeah, it's generally raping, but not okay. always. And because sodomy is always a crime at the time, it's not, they don't really distinguish.
Yeah, that's like, that's so, what I was, yeah. I was sort of like, if that's the term that people are confusing with just like homosexuality.
Yeah, which is obviously totally wrong. There's no comparison between raping someone and having a consensual homosexual encounter.
No,
of course,
two very different,
very very different things. But in this time frame, they wouldn't distinguish. They would just be sodomizing someone, you know. So Karl spent much of his life incarcerated in various prisons before being executed for the murder of a prison employee in 1930. So I actually read a book on Karl Panzram recently, and when I say recently, it was back when I wrote this episode, which was quite a long time ago. But that's basically what prompted me to do this case on the podcast. I honestly didn't expect to find anything particularly engrossing about this case, but I found it interesting for a few reasons. First of all, the time period, the context of the American prison system in that era, the social context. For me, that adds something different. Secondly, we have a lot of Karl's own words about his life, his crimes, and his feelings about his crimes. And that makes up quite a bit of the book, actually. The book is called Panzram, A Journal of Murder, and it's by Thomas Gaddis and James Long, if you're interested in checking it out. Basically, Karl is a brutally violent person who commits murders, rapes, and arsons for personal gain or for seemingly no motive other than causing complete mayhem. But okay. He has this strangely insightful commentary on crime and punishment and why he feels he is the way he is, which I found really fascinating and unexpected. This isn't your average, like, sneaking around, hiding in the shadow serial killer. This is a guy who is just out to, as he says, raise some hell, and truly does not give a fuck.
Okay.
It's not a worldview that you hear directly from often.
Mm.
And the third reason I found this case interesting is why we have these memoirs. And that's because of an unlikely friendship Karl strikes up with a prison guard named Henry Lesser while incarcerated at Leavenworth, a prison in Kansas. Karl began to write Henry letters, which would eventually form a manuscript, an autobiography of sorts. After Karl's death in 1930, Henry Lesser spent decades trying to get the manuscript published. He would end up donating the material to San Diego State University under the title Karl Panzram Papers. Although it was never published in its entirety, it was of course integral to the book that I just mentioned, that was published in 1970, for which the authors got the permission of Henry Lesser to use content from these letters. So without further ado, I think I'm going to start with Karl's early life, as this is where we might typically start. But before I do, I warn you that, as you might have guessed, this case deals with sexual assault, the abuse and murder of minors, and although I will not be going into gratuitous or unnecessary detail on any of those, we will be, like, discussing and mentioning things of that nature. So that's just your standard warning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to start by reading some of Karl's thoughts about his life as written in his autobiographical letters during his incarceration, which includes his anger at those who would try and help him avoid the death penalty. It's a little long, but I think it makes for a good introduction, so bear with me. I started doing time when I was 11 years old, and I've been doing practically nothing else since then. What time I haven't been in jail, I've spent either getting out or getting in again. What you have done and are doing to me, you are also doing to others. What I have done to you, many others also do to you. Thus, we do each other as we are done by. I have done as I was taught to do. I am no different from any other. You taught me how to live my life, and I have lived as you taught me. If you continue teaching others as you taught me, then you as well as they must pay the price, and the price is very expensive. You lose your all, even life. Now, you who do not know me or my wishes, you decide, without consulting me in any way, you start to try to revoke the judgment of a legally consulted court and the sentence that was pronounced on me. I tell you now that the only thanks you or your kind will ever get from me for your efforts on my behalf is that I wish you all had one neck and that I had my hands on it. I have no desire whatever to reform myself. My only desire is to reform people who try to reform me, and I believe that the only way to reform people is to kill them. I may leave here at any time for some big house, madhouse, or death house, but I don't give a damn where they put me. They won't keep me long because no power on earth can keep me alive and in jail for very much longer. I would kind of like to finish writing this whole business in detail before I kick off so that I can explain my side of it, even though no one ever hears or reads of it except one man. But one man or a million makes no difference to me. When I am through, I am all through, and that settles it with me. In my lifetime, I have murdered 21 human beings. I have committed thousands of burglaries, robberies, larcenies, arsons, and last but not least, I have committed sodomy on more than 1,000 male human beings. For all of these things, I am not the least bit sorry. I have no conscience, so that does not worry me. I don't believe in man, God, nor the devil. I hate the whole damned human race, including myself. If you or anyone else will take the trouble and have the intelligence or patience to follow and examine every one of my crimes, you will find that I have consistently followed one idea through all my life. I preyed on the weak, the harmless, and the unsuspecting. This lesson I was taught by others. Might makes right.
There's a lot to unpack there.
So that excerpt maybe gives you a sense of Carl's character, his feeling that he is a product of some kind of cycle and the experiences he's had. And also, like I said, this last part about the, you try to revoke the sentence pronounced on me, I wish I had my hands on your neck. This is directed at those who would try and get Carl off the death penalty by saying he was insane or, you know, whatever. Basically, this gives you an idea of A, he doesn't want to be perceived as mentally ill in any way. That's one thing. But B, he has a paradoxically fair viewpoint on everything. He believes he can go around raising hell and killing people, and also that he absolutely got a fair judgment and should be killed himself. That seems perfectly fine with him. He doesn't want to be advocated for also because, I guess, of that sense of lack of control as well. But there's this humanness to the way he writes and phrases things that I guess just caught me when I was reading this. And by that, I don't mean that he's likable or he's not so bad or anything. I just mean people would like to other someone like as this kind of monster. But to me, he's like very human, and that's real, and it's jarring.
Yeah, it's a funny way to view the world, but it's very, like, matter-of-fact.
I mean, yeah, you're right. He's a funny old guy. So, Carl Panzram was born Charles Panzram in Polk County, Minnesota, in a town called East Grand Forks in 1891. This is one of those things where I re-realized that Carl is short for Charles, which isn't something that I ever think
about. I don't
know
that it always is. Like, it does exist as a name on its own. But I suppose originally,
I think it came from Charles, and now it's like its own thing. But I don't think it was originally its own thing. Like, I think it's also the European, like, Germanic version of Charles.
Version of Charles, I guess.
Yeah. Carl was one of nine children born to two immigrants, Johann Gottlieb Panzram. So I guess maybe that just gone on to explain that. The Carlness of it all. who went by John, though, because,
Makes sense.
And Matilda Elizabeth Baldwin, who went by Lizzie. John and Lizzie had immigrated from what was then East Prussia, a province which today forms parts of Poland, Lithuania, and Russia. Which is stuff that's kind of crazy to me, because it's like, within the last 200 years, there's like whole places with like cultures that just aren't, you know, like now you're Lithuanian, Polish, or, you know, you wouldn't, but within the last 100 years, there's people who were East Prussian.
Yeah.
And now they're just not. Just kind of strange. The couple owned a farm on which all of their children worked from an early age. At the time, laws were only just being passed that mandated that all children in America must attend school. When this happened, unhappy that they were losing their children's labor on the farm during the day, the Panzerams forced their children to work through the night, leaving them with little sleep. And it does, I'm not going to lie, that is pretty horrible. But I guess if you're super poor and you have no other like means of subsistence, I don't want to defend child labor.
I guess, but like...
This is, they're living in the world they're living in, okay? Mm. Like, no judgment. So punishments were harsh in the family, although perhaps not uncommon for the time, but they included restraining the children and withholding food, which are pretty severe punishments. I think at any time, like, I know that it was quite usual to hit your children back in those days, but restraining them and withholding food does seem a bit excessive. So,
well, it's like the baseline, quote unquote, normal standard is that you are just not sleeping. You're not allowed to sleep. So moving on from that.
You're like, right. That, like, that's definitely an abuse in and of itself. And then you have these other things. Carl's father then left the family, which compounded the strain. And Carl began lying and thieving from an early age, according to his own accounts. And the trouble only worsened as he aged. From 8 years old, he was already abusing alcohol, believe it or not. So if
I
you
guess
can imagine...
this is like the late 19th century, right?
Yes. And
I mean,
yet,
not that that's normal, but like Charles Dickens type-esque, like these kids are just running around completely... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean, but I struggle to place like an 8-year-old who's being arrested and jailed for being drunk in public. Like,
yeah,
that's insane to me.
No, that is crazy.
An 8-year-old with a charge of being drunk and disorderly is pretty insane.
It's crazy to like that, first of all, that situation happens, but also that the response is not like, maybe we should do something about this child's like situation because this isn't normal. And instead of that, it's like, no. As with any other person who's drunk in public, we're just going to charge them with it.
Yeah, but I think at this time, there's very little like state infrastructure in that way. So they have like some sort of state services and stuff, but I don't think it was at all the norm for like children to be like followed up on, or like for there to be an extensive social services net. I don't think was a thing. So hence these children are like working on a farm for like hours, going to school and then barely sleeping, etc. In 1903, Carl robbed a neighbor, stealing apples, some cake and a gun. He was sent to the Minnesota...
Until that last one, I was with him.
I mean, yeah, they're just, you know, they're little things, but yeah, happened to steal a gun as well. He was sent to the Minnesota State Training School, which is a reform school. It doesn't exist anymore. A reform school where children were regularly beaten, sexually abused, and subjected to torture. Of course, this is Carl's word that we're taking for this, but I think, unfortunately, that this isn't a very outlandish claim at all. Knowing what boarding schools were capable of being like at this time, and particularly when the stated goal of a school is punishment. Carl claims the room the abuse of students took place in was nicknamed the paint shop due to the blood and bruising a child would leave covered in.
Jesus
which,
Christ.
Yeah, gives you some bit of a flavour of this place. On the school and its supposed Christian values, Carl said, quote, "We were all supposed to go to school half a day and work half a day and the rest of the time learn how to love Jesus and be good boys. Naturally, I now love Jesus very much. Yes, I love him so damn much that I would like to crucify him all over again. When I got out of there, I knew all about Jesus and the Bible, so much so that I knew it was all a lot of hot air. But that wasn't all I knew. I had been taught by Christians how to be a hypocrite, and I had learned more about stealing, lying, hating, burning, and killing. Oh yes, I had learned a hell of a lot from my expert instructors, furnished to me free of charge by society in general and the state of Minnesota in particular. From the treatment I received while there and the lessons I learned from it, I had fully decided when I left there just how I would live my life. I would rob, burn, destroy, and kill everywhere I went and everybody I could as long as I lived. That's the way I was reformed in the Minnesota State Training School. So, a successful program.
Definitely did what it was supposed to.
Yep, they took an abused, drunk 8-year-old and made him a literal murderer.
Good work, guys. Good job.
At 14, Carl was turned loose from reform school, ostensibly reformed, and did not return home, instead becoming a vagrant and travelling around by hitching rides on empty train wagons. He continued to steal and rob people to survive and also began setting fires. During this time, Carl says that he was a victim of a gang rape in a train wagon by a group of fellow vagabonds, a trauma that, of course, affected him deeply and further hardened him to the world. Being so overpowered and vulnerable in this way, on top of his experiences in reform school, likely influenced his drive to turn the tables and become a sexually violent aggressor himself.
Yeah, like, I can't imagine things going much worse for him during his childhood. Like, honest, like, he's 14 at this point.
Yeah, so much has happened to him. Like, you can't even imagine half of that happening to someone.
You could not come up with a worse depiction of childhood.
While still in his teens, Carl got the idea to try joining the US Army, though this was short-lived. Unsurprisingly, he wasn't able to take orders from his superiors. And after being caught stealing army supplies, he was arrested and received his first prison sentence. He was imprisoned at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. Carl believed that this sentence marked the end of any chance he had to turn his life around, and that any inclination he may have had left to do good was henceforth erased. 2 years later, and having been dishonorably discharged from the army, Carl was back on the streets as a now adult criminal and angrier than ever. His range of thefts across different states earned him multiple prison sentences, which he served under various fake names, including John O'Leary, Jefferson Rhodes, Jefferson Baldwin, and Jeff Davis. He likes the Jeffs. I guess it's safe to say he liked the name Jeff.
Also crazy that he can just give a name and they're like, yep. Like, there's just enough of a system for there to be, like,
massive horrible prisons.
An institution of abuse. Yeah. But not enough to actually, like, check or corroborate any information about the people who are being put in these places.
During these stints in prison, Carl only became more aggressive and unruly and received violent treatment from prison staff in return that only exacerbated this further. Carl had grown into a large and intimidating figure and used his strength to overpower and rape other men, whether fellow inmates or victims of his robberies. In 1915, Carl received his longest sentence yet, 7 years at Oregon State Penitentiary. There he received some of his harshest treatment, from stints in solitary confinement coupled with starvation to brutal beatings, probably an attempt to break him. But instead of being broken down, Carl's rage only burned hotter. Then there was a change in prison leadership. A new warden, Warden Murphy, had a different vision for prison life. He believed that giving prisoners freedom, responsibility, and education would help reform them, rather than endless beatings and humiliation.
My God, this guy is like coming in hot, like he's about to reform the whole damn system.
Is he literally from the future? He tried to address overcrowding and to refurbish facilities. Warden Murphy was, if you like, ahead of his time in his line of work, and maybe even now he would be considered quite radical in his approach of trying to connect with even the most tough and violent criminals. Warden Murphy offered Carl understanding, education through reading material, and eventually even allowed Carl to leave the prison in an extremely daring experiment. Interestingly,
I'm not sure about that part of it, but
it's, like I said, he's radical even for now, I think.
Yeah.
But interestingly, Carl returned to the prison and wrote in his memoirs that he wasn't sure why this worked, which I think is quite interesting. For a time, Carl responded somewhat to Murphy's outreach, but unfortunately... Yeah,
like the first person in his entire life to show him, like, a shred of decency.
Any understanding whatsoever. But unfortunately, he was ultimately unable to fully accept the olive branch and this final chance that he had to take a different path. Perhaps he was just too far gone already, but Carl took advantage of Murphy's trust finally in one incident and escaped Oregon State Penitentiary in 1918. This was really embarrassing, obviously, for the prison management.
I mean, that is the right adjective, but it's just funny to be like, ooh, egg on my face, sorry guys.
I mean, imagine trying to explain to the public that, okay, we were trying something, we let out this incredibly violent...
this violent prisoner escaped, right? So it's like, yeah, I mean, he was allowed out. And you're like, what?
Murphy continued to have faith in his methods, but they would not spark any kind of trend in the US prison system of the time. Mm. And that's probably partially because of this slightly embarrassing failure. Though his programs may have had a lot of success statistically, they needed wider scale implementation to show that they had impact. And the cases where it didn't work would always speak more loudly to the public and the government than the cases that did work. So it's kind of one of those doomed things. And I think that's still the case now, where it's like, you know, you're never going to hear about the many times where it works. You're only going to hear about the terrible failures. The programs also cost a lot of money. And if it was hard to justify books and lessons for prisoners during the First World War, it was impossible to justify when the Great Depression hit later in 1929.
Mm-hmm.
So for the moment, Warden Murphy's approach was kind of went down the drain.
But he was really out there trying his best.
He was doing like something really cool, I think. And it's just a shame that, you know, it didn't take because of the time period and the fact that it costs just at the end of the day, that it just costs more money to actually try and reform people than it does to hold and humiliate them. After his escape from Oregon State, Carl decided to spend some time abroad. His longest period outside of an institution during his life would see him interact with honest work properly for the first time. So perhaps in a way, Warden Murphy had a little bit of an impact on him. Carl worked variously on boats as a miner, a labourer, and a driver, moving from Panama to Peru to Chile. Should I say Chile?
I mean, you can put, yeah, go for it.
I'm going to say it right. I'm not going to say Chile. I'm going to say Chile.
Sorry, did you say he was working as a miner on boats?
I said he worked variously on boats as a miner, a labourer, and a driver. So those are four different professions, if you see what I mean.
Oh, right. Okay.
Like working on a boat, then working as a miner, then a labourer, then a driver.
Right.
Not mining on a boat. That would be difficult.
I was just like, how does that work?
Yeah, moving from Panama to Peru to Chile, then back to Panama and Costa Rica. He joined an oil tanker, which took him back to the US, from New York to Texas, and from there to Glasgow, Scotland. Old habits die hard, I guess, because Carl got caught robbing from that ship and did a short stint in a Scottish prison as a result. From there, he went to London, Paris, and Hamburg. In Hamburg, his American dollars were incredibly valuable due to the economic crisis settling on Germany. But in Hamburg, Carl blew all his money there, like on, you know, whatever. He then returned to America.
I love how you set up this as like, after his escape from prison, he decided to travel. Like, after he got his degree, he had a sabbatical. Took a year off.
He took a little quick break from raising hell. Back in the States, Carl began committing his first 10 murders. Murders only known by his later admissions. He was, in the words of the book Panzram, a thoroughly prisonized, totally alienated fugitive, an engine without brakes, fueled by hatred and revenge. He was loose in a world that was consumed with and disillusioned by the First World War.
Hmm.
After acquiring a yacht, the Akiska, I don't know if that's how you're supposed to say that, through the spoils of his burglaries, Carl used the boat as a base to which he lured men. The victims were raped and killed before being discarded in the sea. An interesting note about the purchase of the Akiska: Carl was able to afford such a purchase because he'd robbed the home of William Howard Taft. Again, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but he was the 27th president of the United States.
Oh, that's crazy.
Between 1909 and 1913. So he
was
wasn't
he president
like,
at the time he was
no,
robbed?
No, like, okay. that would be truly mental. No, he'd been president for 4 years, one term, 1909 to 1913. But Carl felt he had a personal vendetta against this guy because back when he was imprisoned for stealing army supplies, way back, William Taft was Secretary of War and he personally signed the sentence. So the two-year sentence, which led to, as Carl believes, a prison stay that was the end of any good side he had. So that was his, like, vendetta he had against William Howard Taft. I keep saying Taft. I don't know if it's Taft or...
I assume it's Taft.
Definitely
I don't know how it's written, but...
Definitely not Taft.
Americans don't typically do that, like, long A sound, do they?
Taft. But... William Taft. That sounds right.
Bill Taft.
apologies to any Americans. So, Carl had managed to make off with significantly valuable jewelry and bonds from
Bill,
ex-president's house, as well as a handgun, which is what he was using to kill.
Just like going in to rob a place and then picking up a gun while he's there.
Well, I feel like it's like everyone just seems to have one. So
yeah, just lying around in the open.
Not even locked up. Like, I guess this is the time where you just have your gun out and you don't care about anything. And the handgun is what he was using to kill the victims during this period. Carl eventually sank the Akiska by accidentally running it aground. So that was the end of his yacht owning era. After skipping bail for an aggravated assault charge, his next move was to stow away on a boat bound for Luanda, Angola, where he worked for an oil company. And if for any reason you don't know where Angola is, this is on the west coast of Africa?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, I'm pretty certain that it's on the west coast of Africa.
Yeah, I'm just going to check that quickly, but I also think that. And we're either right or we're both fools.
I think it's funny how I'm like, if you don't know, Angola's on, where's it?
For those who don't know, including myself, it's crazy to me that this is this time of history where it's like, you can just pick up and leave and fully start a new life somewhere with
and no one will know
ease.
Who you are. Like, no one will know anything about you. There's no checks. There's no nothing. It's
no
like,
one knows anything
I
about
work
you.
On a
you
boat.
You just give a name and they're willing to hire you at any job.
Yeah, it's crazy. During his time in Angola, Carl committed one of his most heinous crimes, or claimed one of his most heinous claims. This was the rape and murder of a boy he believed to be around 11 years old. In another outrageous story of wanton destruction, Carl also claimed to have shot 6 men execution style in one sitting, boasting, "I am a crack shot." The men were locals who had agreed to take Carl to hunt crocodiles in a rowboat. And if Carl's story is to be believed, the crocodiles ate well that day. Carl wrote in his memoirs that he had ideals of larger scale acts of violence and terror. He'd fantasized about poisoning an entire city through its water supply, and thought through in detail how he'd do it. He even thought about trying to start a war between Britain and the US by sinking a British warship while it was docked in New York Harbour.
It's just like, I mean, this it is like, he is just a chaotic guy, but you're just like, why?
I don't want to say I love how big he thinks, but it's crazy how big he thinks. You know, like, normally these, like, profoundly damaged people that become, like, violent, they're just like, they become violent. But he's just like, how can I cause maximal destruction at all times?
Well, it's really interesting because on the one hand, it's like this specific guy who was, like, war secretary or whatever his title was, he is the one responsible for this. Like, I'm pinning everything on this one guy and I have a personal vendetta against one person. But on the other hand, if I could just start a war, which is so general and so, like, non-specific, like, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing about him. It's just, like, he is almost like a walking contradiction, where he's, like, he's saying one thing and then the other thing, doing things that just seem to completely... He's just chaotic.
Yeah.
He's the very definition of chaotic evil. After living in Angola for a year, Carl intended to head for Portugal, but apparently Portuguese authorities had by then caught wind of him somehow. So the system...
Good on Portugal.
After a year, the system begins to slowly work, almost.
Which he hadn't been to Portugal previously, had he?
No, I don't think so. Oh, he might have been.
I don't know what intel they've got, but like
I don't know this for sure, but I actually feel like he might have been to Lisbon once during his like thing of going around Europe, but I don't think he committed any crimes there, so I think it was more a case of like, we know this bad guy's around, and at this time Angola is a Portuguese colony.
Okay.
So they're probably getting some understanding of what's going on in Angola because they're the colonial power there.
Right.
So because of this, Carl had to return to the US instead. Once there, he continued to wreak havoc across multiple states before being arrested in June of 1923, and then going by Captain John O'Leary and in possession of a stolen boat. So he's just like...
Just
totally
like,
taking
how?
The piss.
But it's also so much of it is like, it's hard to know like to what extent this degree of like subterfuge is necessary to like cover his tracks and to what extent it's like he's just having fun with it. Like, yes, I think I'll be a captain this time.
A 15-year-old boy who had been raped by Carl turned him into police, who quickly tracked him down in New York. As usual, being in jail didn't stop Carl from continuing his antics as well as planning escape attempts. He pulled a con on his own lawyer, convincing him to pay his bail in exchange for Carl's boat, and thereby tricking the lawyer into taking ownership of a stolen vehicle, which is actually quite clever.
Jesus Christ.
Once the bail was paid and Carl or John O'Leary was out, he of course didn't stick around, and the trail of mayhem continued with escapades in both the US and Europe again until Carl was once again imprisoned, this time for 5 years in light of skipping bail. And the revelation that he was also Jeff Baldwin, who was a wanted fugitive in Oregon.
So they're putting pieces together.
It's taken, what was it now, like 8 years? But they're getting there. Carl served the 5 years at Dannemora, a large prison and hospital for the criminally insane in New York. He was released in July of 1928, but freedom this time would last a matter of weeks. Carl was arrested again on August 30th, 1928 in Baltimore. This arrest was for a burglary he'd committed 10 days earlier in Washington, D.C.
Again, the information is they're starting to set up a network of some sort, it seems.
When police questioned Carl at this point, he ended up confessing to the murders of teenage boys in three different states, one in Connecticut, one in New Jersey, and one in Massachusetts. A body could be linked to one of these. The remains of a 14-year-old newsboy were found in Philadelphia, New Jersey. Authorities were at first unsure about the veracity of other confessions, but handily they could still resort to good old torture to help understand where the truth lay.
Classic. A known, proven technique that definitely works.
The prisoner stuck to his story, so they took the claims to be true. Which is whatever. I love this idea of like, as well, they're torturing you to try and get you to stop saying that you killed someone.
Yeah.
Instead
they don't
of
want to
you.
Check it out, I guess.
I think
they don't want
to
waste time
like
doing that.
They're torturing someone to avoid work.
Yeah.
But anyway, besides that, Carl Panzerheim also had a rap sheet that was long enough to trail along the floor at this point. So he was given a 25-year sentence, finally. He was imprisoned at Leavenworth in Kansas, but it wouldn't have been the same prison if you remember that he spent 2 years in for nicking stuff from the army. That was Fort Leavenworth, the military prison, whose inmates were the labor force, who then built an enormous maximum security prison for civilians not too far away, the Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. And it was here where Carl would end up at the close of the 20s. So the people who were in the military prison built this new massive prison for regular people. Carl despised Leavenworth. His escape attempts were futile and resulted in extreme beatings, with medical aid withheld afterward and prolonged solitary confinement. Carl openly stated, quote, "I'll kill the first man that bothers me," and he was true to his word. During his duty in the prison laundry room, Carl crossed paths with prison foreman Robert Wonk. Now, that's definitely not right. It's definitely not right. I think it's spelled W-A-R-N-K-E, so maybe like Wonky? Wonke? Wonke?
Well, I don't know. That's too many consonants.
Wonke... Oh, God, now I have to say it loads of times. I'm going to call him Robert. Robert ran the service. He was not well-liked for his bullying behaviour towards the prisoners who were on the laundry service. Carl repeatedly warned the foreman not to rile him up, which is fair.
I mean, he's like...
He's literally he's, like, he's, I'm giving you a warning, like, yeah, I am a vicious murderer.
Please, just leave me alone.
On June 20th, 1929, Carl cornered Robert in the laundry room and, using a 10-pound iron bar he'd gathered from a partially assembled washing machine, beat him to death.
Jesus.
Afterwards, Carl chased other prisoners in a mad rage and headed to the warden's office with murderous intentions. He did actually make it to the office, but incidentally, the warden happened to be elsewhere at the time. This murder of a prison staff member was enough to see Carl facing the death penalty. After advocating for the sentence for himself and strongly resisting a label of insanity that would counter it, Carl was finally sentenced to die by hanging. He was pleased, saying, "I look forward to a seat in the electric chair or dance at the end of a rope, just like some folks do for their wedding night."
Okay. But it does, like, he does have a vibe of, like, it just seems like he's just wanted this to happen for a while. Like, the fact that he confessed to the murders, he's like, these guys are never gonna, like, figure it out if I don't tell them.
Mm.
And then, like, he's almost actively asking for the death penalty. It just seems that he kind of wants to put an end to it, in a way. I think he sort of has this perspective where it's like, I'm just inevitably going to do horrible things to people, and I'm justified in doing that.
Mm.
But so therefore the only response anyone can have faced with me is that you need to kill me, or I'm just going to keep doing these things.
Mm.
And I'm going to keep enjoying doing them.
And so it was that Carl Panzram, seemingly hurtling towards this inevitable end practically from birth, ended up on death row. And yet, it was while on death row that Carl made probably the only friend he would ever have in his whole life, Henry Lesser, a young prison officer who for whatever reason took pity on this huge, terrifying rapist murderer and began offering him money to buy cigarettes. When Carl realised the gesture was genuine, his eyes apparently filled with tears. And from then on, he would smile and chat with Henry. So he took this outreach pretty strongly.
I wonder what prompted this guy to, like, reach out to him. Because that's such an unusual step to take.
I know, and I think part of it was that I don't remember the exact, like, the exact wording around this from the book, but I remember that, you know, like, Henry Lesser wasn't exactly super comfortable with the sort of, like, regime of extreme violence that the prison guards dealt out to the prisoners. And there was a couple of times where Carl was, like, so brutalized that, like, and there wasn't any medical aid given.
Mm.
That his body was, like, put, like, he was almost, like, permanently disabled because he had, like, an ankle broken or something. And he was, you know, like, there's something, I guess, in Henry sort of seeing this horrible person just, like, so vulnerable and so, like, broken, you know, that he sort of couldn't help but reach out to him, like, seeing someone just treated so poorly, no matter what they've done to other people, has, I guess, got to him. So from this moment on, Carl and Henry become sort of unlikely friends. And unlike the reporters that were sniffing around for Carl's story, Henry didn't question Carl for the details or explanations of his crimes. And because of this, this kind of almost reverse psychology happened where Carl wanted to tell Henry everything. And he said to him, I'm going to see that you get the story of my life, all of it. Just keep me fixed with pencil and paper.
It's such an odd dynamic.
Very odd.
It's just, I can't get my head around it, but...
Over the year that Carl awaited execution, Henry bought Carl reading and writing material, subscribed him to magazines and newspapers he requested, and the two exchanged many letters after Henry changed jobs. Carl began to write his life story in full, as we talked about at the start of the episode. Henry shared the graphic and shocking material with psychiatrists who were fascinated to try and understand the mind of such a monstrous individual. But publishers shied away from the deeply disturbing material, even from an educational perspective. One psychiatrist, Carl Menninger, did use some of Carl's material in his book on criminal psychology. Sorry, that's a bit confusing because Carl and Carl Menninger both have the same first name. What I mean is Menninger, the psychiatrist, did use some of the material in his book on criminal psychology, but he referred to Carl using an alias.
I mean, for the time, it's pretty hardcore to publish that kind of stuff.
Carl's relationship with Henry was already somewhat tense at times, obviously. Carl
wasn't... By the nature of him being him.
Yeah, and Carl wasn't super great at interpersonal friendships.
Yeah.
And he hated authority figures and anyone to do with the prison and police.
Which is why this whole thing is so weird to begin with.
Right. When Henry tried to get Carl's thoughts on what psychologists thought of him, Carl reacted mostly with scorn. I think he reacted defensively to the feeling that he was being used, or any trust he might have given out to Henry could have been abused even slightly, and the idea of that would be unbearable to Carl, I would think. Throughout his writings, Carl denied having any remorse for any of his actions and strenuously denied that he was mentally ill in any way. He wrote, "If someone had a young tiger cub in a cage and then mistreated it until it got savage and bloodthirsty and then turned it loose to prey on the rest of the world, to go anywhere and kill anyone it wanted to, then there would be a hell of a roar from those in danger of the mad tiger. Everyone would believe that to be the wrong thing to do. But if some people do the same thing to other people, then the world is surprised, shocked, and offended because they get robbed, raped, and killed. Yet this is exactly what is being done every day in this country. They've done it to me and then don't like it when I give them the same. They do it to thousands of others, and others in turn retaliate by robbery and murder. If you don't like to be robbed, raped, burned, or killed, then stop your own injustices, your own dirty work. Stop your lying and hypocrisy. Live decent yourselves." Which...
Love that he started that metaphor with a tiger, of all creatures.
It's interesting. It's like what you said about personal vendettas. And then it's also like he sort of believes, well, that because of the people that are doing wrong things are representative of everyone.
Yeah.
In his letters to Henry, Carl shared some insights on the state of crime, punishment, and society in 1920s America, which I think are interesting enough to share. Again, I hope that people don't think that by airing too many of this person's thoughts and words, I'm necessarily admiring him or giving him praise in any way. I think that there are probably a lot of people who are like, fuck this guy. Like, don't give raping, looting killers a shred of airtime to say their piece, their scum. And I'm very much understanding of that viewpoint, but I do also think that there's something to be said for what we can learn and gather from the most, I guess, morally corrupt people in our societies about what we can do differently, maybe, to prevent this kind of person from being created in the first place, and how we can help someone before they go too far, if you know what I mean. And I find it interesting that in that it also sheds some light on the historical context. So here's what Carl had to say on crime. "All society is up in arms to combat crime and criminals. They are using every possible method that the law can devise. The best thing they've been able to do so far is build bigger and stronger jails and prisons and fill them full of criminals. Just as soon as a prison is filled to capacity, they start right in building more and more. And they are all full. But still there are more criminals every day, and there is no end under the prison system." Even the most superficial investigator to this question of crime knows this to be a fact. All of your police, judges, lawyers, wardens, doctors, national crime commissions, and writers have combined to find out and remedy the cause and effect of crime. With all of the knowledge and power at their command, they have accomplished nothing except to make conditions worse instead of better. This is not a theory, this is a fact. Statistics prove it beyond any possibility of doubt. The criminal does not profit by his crimes. It's the lawmakers and law enforcers who do profit the most. They, in reality, are the real cause of the most crime. They know it too. That's why there is so much crime in this country today. Those who roar loudest about putting down crime are the very ones who cause the most crime. I am 36 years old and have been a criminal all my life. In my lifetime, I have broken every law that was ever made by both man and God. If either had made any more, I should very cheerfully have broken them also. The mere fact that I have done these things is quite sufficient for the average person. Very few people even consider it worthwhile to wonder why I am what I am and do what I do. All they think is necessary to do is to catch me, try me, convict me, and send me to prison for a few years, make life miserable for me while in prison, and then turn me loose again. That is a system that is in practice today in this country. The consequences are that anyone and everyone can see crime and lots of it. Those who are sincere in their desire to put down crime are to be pitied for all of their efforts which accomplish so little in the desired direction. So, you know.
I do see some of the points he's making where it's like, you need to question why there is so much crime and why people are turning to, like, why people are resorting to crime. There are also some parts where it's like, no one's trying to figure out why I'm doing this. And I'm like, isn't he like not telling, like lots of people want to know why he's doing this and he doesn't want to talk to them.
Yeah, I think he's still got that slight, like he's not the smartest guy in the world. I think he likes the attention. He's like, I'm not going to tell you anything. Nobody's even trying to understand me.
Yeah. And even if you tried, you couldn't. You just wouldn't get it.
So... But I think it's really interesting that he picks up on the profit motive of crime and punishment, which is a debate that still rages on in the US today and like arguably is worse than ever in some ways. And, you know, he makes a good point that, you know, nothing was happening. You know, like he's like, well, nothing's getting better. Like, and there's more people than ever trying to make it better, but you're obviously going about it the wrong way. So it's also just the state of society at the time was such a harsh place to live.
He has this attitude where it's like society is fucked and we need to change it, but also people who are trying to change it aren't doing it, so fuck them. And it's that same attitude of like people who are harmed by society are going to go on to harm society, but that's just the way it is, so fuck everyone. And it's like okay, but like it's that thing of like not necessarily contradicting but just having like really paradoxical thoughts.
He never really got a childhood, so there's this thing of like when people have their childhood taken from them, they never mature like mentally. So his worldview, it could also be said to be as simplistic as like a child's and as contradictory as a child's can be. It's like a child can sort of hold these very remedial opinions that kind of seem to contradict with other opinions they have and are also very like, you know, basic in their reasoning.
But it's also typical, you know, on any scale, anyone who's struggled to do something or has had difficulty in life feels like everyone should have to, that it's justified in, like, because you went through this experience, other people should have to go through it as well. Because otherwise you realize how incredibly unfair life was to you.
So after a few delays, Karl Panzram was finally executed on September 5th, 1930. When the hangman attempted to place a hood to cover Karl's face before the execution, the prisoner spat in the hangman's face. Karl's last words, responding to the question of if he had any, were as follows. Yes, hurry it up, you Hoosier bastard. I could kill a dozen men while you're screwing around.
Oh my god.
I don't know what a Hoosier was, but apparently it's just a nickname for someone from the state of Indiana. So there's that.
Was he in Indiana?
No.
At this time?
No. No, he was in Kansas.
Okay. All right.
So I don't know, like, I don't... If probably like if it sounds like obviously it's an American slang term for something, and there is a band I think called the Hoosiers. Huh. I also don't know if I'm saying the word right. I'm just assuming that it's Hoosier and not like Hoosier, just because Hoosier is easier to say. But it's Hoosier. Oh, is there like a one guy called Hozier as well? Hozier?
Yeah, isn't he a singer? Is that, I don't know how you actually pronounce his name, but I've...
Okay. Well, I wonder if that has anything to do with it. But like when I looked it up, it just said it's a nickname for someone from Indiana. So I don't know. But I don't know how that became a thing. But like an American might understand it a bit more than I do.
It sounds somewhat derogatory in any
Well,
case.
The fact
or
that
he's
saying,
using it in that
he's
way.
Saying you Hoosier bastard makes it derogatory, I guess. But like I could say this, like I could say to you, you blue-eyed bastard. And I can make it derogatory, but it doesn't it's not necessarily on its own a problem. So Carl was buried in Leavenworth's prison cemetery. Apparently his grave is still there, but it's not marked with his name. It's marked with his prisoner number, which was 31614. If you're ever in the neighborhood and want to check it out. So that's
can,
it.
Can people visit a
I
prison
don't know.
Graveyard?
I have no idea. I don't even know.
Is it still an active prison?
So, yeah, no, apparently Leavenworth is an active prison. It's a medium security prison now. So that's it for the case of Carl Panzram. There's a lot of detail in this case and in Carl's life. So if you know this case well, you know that there's elements that I've compressed or even left out or simplified. But I mean, if I went through every little detail, I might as well read like hours of his manuscripts directly to you.
Mm-hmm.
So just in the interests of time and pace, I haven't included the minutiae, shall we say. Recommended reading for this episode, as I mentioned earlier, is the book Panzram, A Journal of Murder by Gaddison Long. So check that out if you're interested in a lot more depth about his story. I think it's definitely worth a read. Don't forget to subscribe and that we're on social media. Follow us on Twitter @aboutmurder, Instagram @apodcastaboutmurder. Facebook.com/apodcastaboutmurder with no E, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Search channels for A Podcast About Murder. Please do like and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and give us a fantastic rating, of course. If you have any suggestions for the show, we're always open to those as well. You can even send us an email. It's apodcastaboutmurder@outlook.com. I'm thinking about maybe getting rid of the Twitter just because it's not as high traffic of a thing, and I don't want to have it
as opposed to Facebook, which is really...
Well, you say that, but we have a lot more follows on Facebook.
Like, really?
Yeah, so more people appear to be there than... Yeah. I mean, if you love like the fact that we have Twitter, let us know, but I don't think that's... You know, I don't want to think about updating it all the time if it's... Maybe I'll just leave it, but I don't know if I'll... You know, put effort into it or anything. Yeah, so that's that. That's the first episode. We're back. Woo! But as always, have a great weekend and see you next Friday.
Yeah. See you then, guys.
Bye. I'm going to press the button.